Is the world on fire? Hi, everyone. You're listening to a podcast created by students and alumni at the Kroc School of Peace Studies at the University of San Diego. I'm your host, Clara Nithya Perrin. And today, we're excited to bring you a special three-part series interviewing the activists who have been selected for the 2023 to 2024 Women Peacemakers Fellowship at the Kroc School. Our fellows are joining us from Afghanistan, Burma, and Iran to share their unique perspectives on what it takes to build peace from the diaspora. Welcome to part two of our special Women Peacemakers series, where I am excited to interview Shadi Rushabaz, an Iranian peace builder, activist, futurist, and researcher whose work focuses on youth, gender, peace, and security. She is the founder of Peace Mentors, the first young women-led peace-building initiative in Iran. Listen in to today's episode as we discuss underground activism, the Iranian information gap, and the human cost of getting the world to look at you. Thank you so much for being here, Shadi. I am really looking forward to our conversation. So let's dive in. What did you think you would be when you grew up?
Thank you so much for having me. Yeah. It's honestly a humbling experience to be here. I wanted to be a teacher when I grew up. Unlike many children who wanted to be like a doctor one day and a nurse another and a firefighter or a pilot, I always wanted to be a teacher. And I think that was because my first teachers were really, really wonderful people. I was almost 3 years old when I went to an English kindergarten. And that was where I met my first teacher, whom we call Maryam Jun. And she was the embodiment of love, discipline, and support. When I completely embarked into another language, another world, and try to make new friends and make a community for myself. And that really sort of inspired me to be the same person, to sort of create that for other people in my community as I grew up. In my context in Iran, a lot of people say they want to be doctors or engineers or lawyers, but I wanted to be a teacher. And then when I turned 16, I actually became a teacher. I started teaching English and French as a side job when I was a high school student. So the vision became a reality. And now I am working towards hopefully becoming a lecturer and eventually university professor, even though I've done so many other jobs ever since.
So, okay, you've taught English and French, and I also saw that you're quite interdisciplinary. So you mentioned that you have two master's degrees, one in English literature and one in international development. And personally, I have a similar background. So what do you make of this intersection and how has it contributed to your research and journey thus far?
I think we are in the century of interdisciplinary studies and work because things are even more so interrelated than they were even, let's say, 10 years ago or 20 years ago. I studied English literature because I was really interested in drama. And that also comes back to my teaching, because you want to be very dramatic when you teach in a good way, but just you want to engage your audience. The first thing that was closest to my mind was English literature. But then I grew to learn through literature, mostly through prose and fiction, that a lot of the lives and the stories that are around us actually come in books. And sometimes our imagination goes beyond what we see. So throughout high school and throughout college, I was that one person with books all the time. Mm-hmm. Not academic books, really, not school textbooks, but mostly novels, mostly stories that I really, really loved from different parts of the world. Through my academic background in English literature, what I loved most was literature in English and not so much British or literature coming from English-speaking countries. But just being able to read a piece of, literature in an original language and then see how it's translated. And sometimes we don't have the privilege to speak all those languages, but we try to get some common ground by reading a translation and then investigating more. or even being inspired to read that piece in an original language someday. So that's what really got me. Language as a medium of connection and as a medium of preserving literatures and stories of different people. And when it was time to do my master's degree, I focused on apartheid literature in South Africa. And I went to Cape Town and went to a couple of townships there to look at the situation as an outsider who did not belong to any of the sides of the apartheid in South Africa. And my mind was blown. Like, when I came back, I was a different person. And I know it's very cliche, but there is something really powerful about reading books and reading, you know, scripts or poetry from a region in the world, and then going to see what really inspired that art coming out of the mind and the heart of the author or the poet. So I chose to look at the nuances of peace, conflict, and violence in two literary works in my dissertation, a script and a novel, which to date, I believe that has been the most fascinating and engaging research experience that I had, even though it was purely desk-based research. And I just chose to do the empirical part by exposing myself to the context of South Africa, which is very rich in so many ways. So that's how I realized I want to do more than just read and think about these pieces and more than just research and cite them. And I wanted to be able to do something. And that's when I got accepted into my second master's program, which is the Master's in International Development with a minor in Migration and Mediation. And that took me over 3 years of, almost 3 years of exciting journeys between Italy, France, and Tunisia, which obviously ended in COVID. But, but I still managed to travel and then cease and study and research throughout my academic journeys there. It was wonderful because I studied anything that I could about the migratory journeys of people in the Mediterranean and Euro-Mediterranean sphere. It helped me understand the conflicts that exist and that have existed in the regions from the Middle East, North Africa, to the Balkans, to World War in Europe. And it was really eye-opening as to how those conflicts from the past shape our present and, most importantly, our future, which is now what I am I'm more interested in. Another thing that was mind-blowing about this interdisciplinary work is the theories that you read when you're a literature student. So, you know, Marxist theories, feminist theories, constructivism, all of this, gender theories, and then you see them manifest in the real world of the work that you do when you're writing projects or when you're trying to actually research with a community in a certain concept. So we can see how these are interrelated. And I feel that should be the future of literature, to be a little bit more connected and active with the realities. And the international development, while still being grounded in those theories, needs to become a bit more relevant to the stories of people. And that's where I stand with my work.
Let's talk about what you're doing right now. Now, you've brought all of this interdisciplinary research. You've channeled it into this organization as well. So it's called the Peace Mentors, and you started this right before you left Iran. Can you walk us through the everyday difficulties of organizing and peace building in Iran?
Thank you for that question. So I started Peace Mentors in 2018 because at that time, a lot of my contemporaries, a lot of young Iranians needed a space to be able to safely talk about peace and conflict. There's no war at that time, and I hope it stays so within my context. But for some reason, when you asked my classmates or folks around me whether they feel like we are a country at peace, they would not really jump to say yes. So sometimes they would say, well, yeah, there is no war. And other times the answer was, yeah, but I don't feel like we're also in peace. So we wanted to start talking about that. And because it's very difficult to do work that is not, you know, fully observed or scrutinized by the government, it had to be an underground initiative. It started in the backyard of one of our members because that was the only venue in which we felt safe And honestly, because we didn't have the money to rent an office. And even if we did have that money, renting an office for commercial use needs permits. And when you choose to ask for a permit, you choose to expose your work. And that's not what we wanted. We wanted that to be a safe space where people just felt like, you know, they're chilling, they're talking together, and every voice and opinion is welcome and respect is held up as a principle of discussion. So we started there. We started with a very small group of five people. All of this work has almost always been 100% volunteer-based. We scaled our work to a workshop with United Nations Information Center, UNIC, in Iran. And I was at that time also working there. So we organized a symposium on Nelson Mandela Day to celebrate all of his values and how that translates into our work. So that symposium that we organized on that day was an opportunity for us to showcase a training of trainers that we had organized for 17 young people, and how they had taken what they've learned to work with two NGOs, one of them that worked with differently abled people and the other one with children who are often victims of child labor in Iran. So it was a really wonderful start to our work, partially because I could, you know, through my work there, ask for the space to showcase our work, which was safe to us. And if it was approved by a UN office in Iran, then it would most likely be a safe environment for my members and for all the beneficiaries and participants in our projects. The next thing that we foresaw was obviously, you know, scaling our work more. But the problem is when you're an unregistered organization, and this is one of the biggest challenges that not just we face in Iran, but many young people face in the world, there's this sort of mistrust, whether it is from donors or partners, because somehow being registered gives you credibility, whereas in my context, it's not necessarily the case, and in many other contexts. So we had no official bank account, no donor records, no auditing, no due diligence of any sort that was formal enough to present even to local partners or sponsors. And also the very fact that anything that was not highly commercialized was not a thing to, you know, be welcomed by sponsors, because they always want, and I think this is the case around the world, they always want to see some financial return on their investment. Whereas with the work that we did may not have had an immediate financial return, but it did go on to create a sustainable space for thought and for dialogue with marginalized communities. And that's why we relied on co-funding in the way that if we partnered with a bigger institution like the Tehran Peace Museum, for example, that they would offer, you know, refreshments for breaks in our workshops, and they'd offer us the venue. But everything else, from the supplies and the stationery that we took for the workshops, to the transport costs, to the time and skills that were shared, was completely voluntary. Now, this problem scales at the international level because we can't get any funding into Iran. The bank sanctions on Iran prevents any sort of international banking transfer into Iran because your Visa cards and your MasterCards won't work in the country. And many donors just have excluded Iran off their list where they're working. So if we were to receive a grant, it would have to work in a way where the organization would trust me as a person who is based outside of Iran to transfer that money to me. And then I would have someone transfer the equivalent to my team in Iran. Which obviously comes with a lot of trust and a lot of informal networks and a lot of informal economy just to do the activities that we were doing and we still are doing. Another challenge that we face is the safety and security of our members, because whenever there was a shift in the political landscape, whether in Iran or in the region or in the world, we had to scale down. We had to stop doing our activities because the safety of our members and anyone associated with our work was always most important. So we could never have, a steady increase in our work or a steady impact increase in the projects that we did. And that's where I feel very, very disappointed, because the Western way of looking at monitoring and evaluation is very quantitative. So bigger numbers, more people reach, but it's not really much outcome focused or impact focused. It's more about how many people you reached and the big numbers that you can present to defend your case. Not so much the stories of life that have been among the, let's say, smaller population that you've reached in a context that's so constrained. And another challenge is that there's really no good understanding of the context in Iran. It's very sad to say it, but if you've been cut off the country for 3 to 4 decades, there's no local news, there's no way to get people into the country, and embassies or missions are completely cut off from the work of young people. And there's no EU delegation, to the surprise of many people, no US embassy, no other, channel of communication between the young people and the international forces, then that isolation happens. So whenever I talk abroad, whenever I present something about my country, even though I've been personally doing so for the past 4 to 5 years, it's very surprising to everyone. And after some time, it gets a little bit frustrating.
Let's touch a little bit on the narrative shift that comes with all of this work of women specifically that you mentioned in one of our conversations earlier, from being labeled a terrorist to a brave woman in Iran. So how did this shift come about and how do women feel about it nowadays?
Yeah, back to what I was talking about, no good and clear understanding about Iran. The general, I would say, average, and I'm trying to actually generalize here, the average perception towards the Middle East is that it's a really big country with lots of people who are, you know, terrorists or Arabs or Muslims and who are just living there. And I don't think that in the world today where we are armed with knowledge, and that I, you know, intentionally use the word armed, because our information, our access to resources is actually what makes us different and then empowers us. With this option and this access, we are still living by stereotypes and still failing to create awareness, raise awareness, and spread that information. So let's say, not even 2 years ago, I would say, as the only international student in my master's program. The rest of them were all European students. When I chose to study abroad, I was shocked at the level of not even misinformation or disinformation, but like this gap of information about my part of the world, specifically about Iran. There was just headlines of a few people that they knew. And the ones who had actually traveled to Iran were the ones that could, you know, talk to me in a way that made sense about intangible things. And the number of times I have been stopped at an airport with a very, very deep, sophisticated gaze and my passport and then on my face as an Iranian woman, like I've just run out of count. And as a population, I don't want to speak on behalf of everyone, but I've heard the many common stories of when someone asks you, where are you from? And you say, I'm from Iran. They think you're from Iraq. And that's an unfortunate truth. Or you have to self-justify. I am from Iran. We're very kind. We're very hospitable. Really nice people. Like I've never seen someone from Norway justify being Norwegian or someone from any other part of the world, except I would say countries where there is a lot of misunderstanding about that population. But then the Women Life Freedom Movement happened last year in September. And, you know, the Times magazine got Iranian women on its cover. Social media was flooded with stories of very young, maybe 15, 16 years old, young women protesting, doing things that are inhumanly brave and courageous. And then people took it upon themselves to use those resources, the media, articles, social media even, to educate themselves. Obviously not to the level of perfection, but that general awareness towards what is happening in that piece of land, which happens to be Iran, that sort of fired up. And suddenly everything was more lenient towards me. people celebrated the courage of Iranian women. And then I swear I'm still the same person that I was before. My work got more visible. I got access to more platforms that came obviously with more responsibility. But that narrative shift is what I believe has transformatively impacted people inside Iran too. The sheer fact that the world is noticing things that has been intentionally covered up, I think that's a really big, big shift in the work that we're doing. At least we're fighting less, I would say, or at least we're gathering our energy to fight at the better fronts, at the fronts that are needed more. That's how I would summarize the answer to this question.
I'd love for you to like specify a little bit more about the social movement itself, Women, Life, Freedom. What kind of incidents did it bring about with like terms of solidarity? And what are some constraints faced as regard of, you know, this whole movement, even on social media and in the domestic reality of Iran?
So the Women, Life, Freedom movement, it occurred as a result of Mahsa Jina Amini, a 22-year-old Kurdish-Iranian woman, being arrested and later dying at the hands of the morality police in Tehran. And that sparked a lot of outrage across the country. It's definitely not an isolated incident. A lot of Iranian women have the experience of being stopped by the morality police and all sorts of other forces, armed forces in the country, and being picked on because of the way that they're appearing, you know, their clothing, their makeup, even at university levels, like having something like nail polish. So all of this has been the ordinary experience of ordinary people. And once, unfortunately, she was declared dead, the entire population started reclaiming, you know, their voices and their rights and speaking out loudly about the injustices that they faced over the past 3 to 4 decades. It's very sad to hear that just 2-3 weeks ago, on the 29th of October, Armita Garavand, another 17-year-old girl, also suffered precisely the same fate. She was engaged in a fight with a hijab enforcer in the subway, was part of the morality police, and she was taken to the hospital, was in a coma for a few weeks, and then declared brain dead. This is not what Iranian people want. This is not what anyone will want in their daily life. It is just death upon death and loss of precious lives. So many young Iranian women and men either died during the protests or were executed or had their freedoms and rights taken away from them. They had their passports confiscated. They were detained for a number of, with no end in sight, in the most horrible conditions. A lot of them lost their eyes and their vision because they were shot at by pellet guns. And a lot of them suffered from a lot of mental health issues upon their release, and threats against their families and themselves continued. I think this is one of the biggest challenges of the Women, Life, Freedom movements, the human cost. So it takes human cost to have the world look at you. Honestly, it sometimes feels like Hollywood movies, like the main character is about to die or is dead. And that's when, you know, everyone else in that movie comes to the realization that, oh, there is something actually wrong. And what do we do right now? Or how can we stop that from happening? And this human cost is, I would say, the most dreadful challenge that we face. To reclaim our rights, we have to pay in lives. But at the same time, we also face so many other mobilization challenges. So anything that has a political edge, anything that has to do with rights, anything that has to do with demands, citizen demands aligned with human rights within a country, is suppressed and completely shut off at its core, with a lot of threats and a lot of challenges. Anything that has a feminist edge to it is declared to be problematic. It's very easy to frame these things as waging war against God or threatening national security or collaborating with a national enemy and threatening national security. All these political buzzwords that are just easy enough to put someone behind bars for decades, as they did to two journalists who reported the death and the funeral of Mahsa Jinnah Amini. The absence, or the, I would like to call it shrinking of civic spaces, but in our case, it's really the absence of civic space in Iran, creates so much pressure and so much fear, to the point that families are so concerned about their teenagers and their youth, their schools being targeted with poisonous gas to create fear among brave student activists in Iran. And it's really sad to say that the movement, which was following the world famous slogan "Women, Life, Freedom," that had completely civic demands, is now seen as a threat to the security of the country by the current government. When the demands are very, very humane, it's about what you want to wear, how you want to go out of your house. It's about women having equal rights. It's about an economy that actually functions and provides livelihoods for its people in a country where there is 60% inflation. It's a really massive number. Just to give you an idea, one U.S. dollar is an equivalent of 514,000 Iranian riyals. As I'm talking today in this episode, it will probably be more when the listeners are listening to it. There's a massive challenge with regards to the internet. So when the civic space is completely shut off, then you use alternative spaces, like let's say my initiative did. And one of these alternative spaces are anything that has to do with social media spaces. So could be your Instagram account. It could be surveys and research spaces on different platforms. It could be petitions. It could be tweeting and using even a platform like LinkedIn, which is usually a job searching or professionally oriented platforms. But with the internet being cut off at that, you know, different random hours at different days, and with Iran's efforts towards making the internet completely nationalized without access to international websites and domains, such as even Google and Gmail, that is another challenge that our movement sees and how to go above and beyond their efforts. So one of the things that was really trending at the beginning of the Women Life Freedom Movement, when we were yet again in a total internet shutdown, was trying to use Starlink or alternative internet options to still keep Iran and Iranians connected to the world, as many atrocities were happening and as many freedom-seeking demands were being made. I think one of the last challenges that I want to mention is a lack of cohesion within Iran and within the diaspora. And it's a totally fair challenge to have, because for the past four decades, anything that had to do with mobilization, with campaigning, with creating movements on platforms, was mobilized by individuals or groups. There have rarely been mobilizing parties or alternative political parties. There's either a reformist movement or a pro-status quo movement, but none of that has been translated into a formed opposition, which can, you know, democratically get votes. Anyone from that sort of space would be completely blacklisted and removed. So a lot of women have organized protests and have organized campaigns, like the 1 million signature campaigns for gender equality, Myself the Freedom, Women of Enghilab Street or Women of Revolution Street, the White Scarves, which are women who wanted to enter the football stadium, which is still a struggle today, and the Me Too movement of Iran, Feminism Every Day. These are all wonderful efforts that have been, you know, created and are still ongoing by Iranian women in different corners of the country and the world. But there is no unification of these. In the diaspora, we're also very fragmented. So each group wants certain things that the other doesn't. And in order to change, to create a paradigm shift, we have not been, I would say, that well educated to create cohesive social movements. The education has always been towards maintaining the current status quo, and whatever opposes it must be completely shut off and destroyed. So this is a thing that is, I would say, daily practice, that's daily learning. While women do use civil disobedience to stay up to date with their beliefs and with their practices, and their demands. Abroad, we are mobilizing, we're organizing protests, organizing events, and we're using our international platforms and privileges to create the civic activism that we lack inside of Iran because of safety and security concerns, to sort of combat this isolated voices within the country and abroad.
Concerning, you just mentioned this heavy absence of civic space, right? And I think I can relate to that because even in Sri Lanka, there is that absence. And there is sometimes this need for an active international involvement, right? So you have said about Iranian women, we know that no one from the outside world is going to save us. How does this attitude impact your own personal journey? And how does it feel to know this as a figure in the diaspora community?
This is a great question. Yeah. Throughout the days after the Women Life Freedom Movement started, many of my friends, many of my community members were going above and beyond by trying to find VPNs and anti-filter programs to circumvent the heavy filtering and internet cuts in Iran, just to be able to come on Twitter, which is now called X, and to put their demands and their anger and their desperation and that fire that fuels their activism on social media so the world could see. So we managed to make the Mahsa Amini hashtag trend for many, many days and weeks. There is this inherent, I would say, I can call it even anger within our community because the world has systematically isolated Iran. So there is this desire to be seen and to be heard. And at the beginning of the movement, we managed to attract that international attention. But when it came to concrete actions, when there were demands made and requests put forward front and center, the international community yet again disappointed Iran. A lot of women in parliaments cut their hair in solidarity with the Iranian women. Nobel Prize was given to Narges Mohammadi, a prominent Iranian women's rights activist who is in jail. And as I speak, on a hunger strike, many prizes were given to Iranian women. Many streets were named after Mahsa Amini. But unfortunately, when it came to concrete, tangible demands, the only thing that was, I would say, quite impactful was placing targeted sanctions against specific people within the current government of Iran. So yeah, no one really out there from the international community, including the United Nations or European Union, are actually listening and taking the measures that Iranian people have asked, whether it's declaring a certain group as a terrorist organization or using the principles within international law to uphold justice and put on trial, you know, people who have killed many, many Iranians in the past 3 to 4 decades. So it's ultimately up to Iranian women. Now, within the diaspora, things are a bit tricky because you can't 100% understand what people want back home. And it's really difficult to get that information without putting someone's life at risk. Because even communicating with especially Iranian women who have change-making history can put them at risk. And we really kind of have to make sure within the diaspora that we reflect as much as possible the demands and the needs of Iranian women so that we can create change abroad and fight all of these structures that are not actually doing what we want them to do. But, you know, just showing, you know, thoughts and prayers and support to the Iranian women. There's this really nice and important quote that I invite the listeners to seek within the book Wicked Problems in a chapter called The Ones Who Walk Away to Stay and Fight. This is pretty much, you know, very close. It hits very close when we talk about Iranian diaspora. So quote says, "The ones who walk away will face obstruction, exclusion, marginalization, and resource scarcity that will test their resolve. The battle will never stop. Those who succeed will find themselves showered with praise, attention, and funds once more, structured to co-opt. Some will divert and others will march on." I think this really resonates with different parts of our diaspora. Some of us really still are very closely attached to home. Others have embraced their second home a little tighter and closer. So a lot of the influence that their second home has left on them becomes a major part or a major characteristic of their fight for Iranian freedom and Iranian liberation. But ultimately, being part of the diaspora and fighting for home is a double-edged sword. From one side, you do feel the importance and the privilege and the power that you have to speak freely and not die for it. But from the other, you do know that you are fighting the international community that is not always responsive. And sometimes it's difficult to communicate this inside Iran because there's a lot of pressure on you to represent properly and to use the resources and the excesses that you have in a transformative manner. And it's difficult to explain that we face apathy. Sometimes we face lack of awareness and we face our own personal problems. We still Iranian citizens, or at least some of us are. We still face the same visa barriers, financial excesses are limited, and then the identity challenge of just, you know, starting from zero in another country.
So earlier we spoke about this focus on the quantitative aspect of monitoring and evaluation a little, but there's not so much of a focus on personal stories. And in your pre-talk, we did this activity, which was the Future Wheel activity, where we do structured brainstorming, identify unintended negative and positive consequences in peace building. So it looked at mapping out what you want to change, the direct impacts, and then the indirect impacts. Can you quickly talk our audience through this activity?
Absolutely. So we talked about so many challenges that we've had, and I don't want this episode to be depressing because there are still opportunities. And I think the key outside, you know, all the constraints, the key that we have is to envision futures and how we get to those futures, whether it's from inside Iran or in the diaspora. And I think this is not a method that's only limited to Iranians. I think everyone should be able to, you know, Google the Futures Wheel, get more information about it. But just to give a clear introduction to it, things that happen within the context, and let's say Iran's context, do not happen in isolation and they do not happen in a vacuum. They're interrelated and they impact factors that are within our context and also influence one another. So they're interchangeably influential. So something that happens, let's say a protest that happens in Iran can completely influence Islamophobia in the Middle East and then cause, let's say, France to strengthen and tighten up their anti-Islamic rules. Or it can be about the economic transformations that happen around the world, such as the prices of oil. It can be influential on the foreign policy or feminist foreign policies, more specifically, and how they're reformed. I think these are things that are more nuanced, and I would like to specifically attract the attention of our international audience, especially those who are in the policymaking spaces or within you know, international cooperation, to look at how a movement inside a certain context can influence the bigger scale of things around the world, and how if we intervene at a certain level of impact or a certain level of consequences, we can prevent more risks and more tragedies, or we can actually create more opportunities and benefits, not just for the local population, but for the world. And I think that's when the world will really put aside that reluctance of action and understand that there's everyone's lives at stake, not just Iranian women or the Iranian population.
This is one quote that really stuck with me during your pre-talk. And you said, and I quote, "If you're part of the freedom-seeking movement, you're not in peace during your lifetime, and you're not in peace during your death." I know that this is a very gravitating quote, but can you elaborate on this?
Absolutely. Whether you're home or you're abroad, your country never leaves you. Even if you get five other passports, some part of you will always be Iranian, and you can just replace that with the nationality that you belong to. I think not being in peace, it's not a state of being. So you are always in a sort of fluidity and movement from where you are to where you go. And to me, that state of, you know, euphoric nirvana of peace, where you don't have to worry about people getting killed. You don't have to think about how you're going to contact your family if the internet gets cut, or the prices of foreign currencies and the exchange rate. I don't think that exists in the lifetime of anyone who's been fighting for peace. And these are just a few examples. But when we die, when the Iranians who have been part of the Women Life Freedom have died, they have not been left in peace either. The chances of, you know, mourning and having a proper funeral has been taken away from their families. Some of them have been forced to hide the funerals from public view and to, you know, organize it overnight in a random cemetery. And I think this is completely unfair. It's actually a disgrace to humanity to not be able to mourn the loved ones who have passed for such a noble cause. They could all be silent and complicit, but they've stood up for what they find important as justice. And to me, I think the only time we will be in peace, our freedom-loving and justice-seeking people will be in peace, is in the future, beyond our deaths, whether natural or at the hands of people who oppose our completely reasonable and human rights-oriented desires. Because when the future arrives, certain things that cause that damage and that preoccupation and that stress have been resolved. So you no longer have to worry about the basic things that are a threat to your integrity, to your mental health, and to your life, such as the way that you dress or what you eat and where you go, and the right to leave the country freely as you wish, and whether, you know, the amount of money you get at in your bank account helps you make it to the end of the month. And the futures that we envision and that we create, and then I do really encourage everyone to lean more into futurism, to be able to create those futures, that is when we are truly in peace. And I don't think there's a moment in it that you'll be in peace. It's just that you will be in more peace as you move forward as compared to the current stressful and really threatening situations that we faced in the past year and a half and even more.
Thank you so much, Shadi. This conversation has been insightful. Thank you for being here in person and for all the work that you do.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to today's episode with Shadi Rushabas. Before you go, we want to hear from you. Share your questions, stories, or ideas on the fires you see in today's world. Contact us on Instagram at Croc School or via email at istheworldonfire@gmail.com and let us know. What is your fire? Today's episode was produced by myself, Clara Nithya Perrin, and Harry Schilling, with special help from Scott Lundergan and Ryan Murphy. It was edited by Jim O'Connell and includes original music by Victor Daniel Castro Escobar. Promotion is made possible by Kevin Dobbins, Tony Campos, and Andrew Byros. Tune in next time.